Jesus tells us to take up our cross and follow him. You're listening to Crosswalk with Pastor Steve Winery. Crosswalk is the radio ministry of Calvary Chapel Tri-Cities, and it is our aim to lead you to the cross through the teaching of God's word.
Come break our culture, tear down our pride. Lord, take your church and purify. Oh, we are ready to stand in your love. Come, King Jesus, deliver us. Oh, my King is coming. Restless hearts, be still.
What you see there is the end of the Battle of Armageddon. Battle of Armageddon starts with the kings of the east coming from the far east. A king from the north comes down from the north. That would be Russia. And then you have the 10 nations that are confederated with the Antichrist coming in, this whole thing. And they all meet in Israel. And there's a great battle that takes place in the Valley of Megiddo. Jesus interrupts that battle. And it looks like what happens is when they see Jesus coming, they turn their weapons on him. And it's pretty wild, because when the Bible describes the second coming of Christ, it describes it as the sky splitting. And they see the Lord coming back. And you have this whole thing with him coming back, and everybody's riding white horses, they're flying through the air. And so the natural thing is not to, you know, hit your knees and repent. It's to take your weapon and start firing at some dude that's flying through the air from a split sky. This is how hardened these people are. In any case, it says that verse 20, then the beast was captured. And this is why I wanted to read in this passage. And with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone, and the rest were killed with the sword which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. And so this is a pretty lopsided battle. So Jesus comes back, and the beast and the false prophet are cast in the lake of fire. In 2 Thessalonians, it says that the Antichrist, the man of sin, is destroyed by the brightness of Jesus' coming. And so this is giving you the specifics on what's taken place. So those two are cast alive into the lake of fire, and the rest of the armies that were fighting against Christ are killed with the sword that comes out of Jesus's mouth. And all that means is Jesus goes, I am, and you were, and then they're dead, basically. Remember the Garden of Gethsemane? Jesus goes, who are you looking for? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth, and he says, I am. They all fall over backwards. That tells you the power of the word that comes out of Jesus' mouth. He can knock you over with a word. He can also wipe you out with a word. That's exactly what he does with these armies. And so they end up dead, while the beast and the false prophet go into the lake of fire. Okay, so right now I'm not going to go into a big old deal with this, but I'm really quickly going to talk to you about the hells in the Bible, because there's more than one hell. And so the Bible teaches that there's a place that's called Hades, and in the old King James Version it translates it hell, and sometimes it translates it the grave. In the Old Testament, that same place, Hades, is called Sheol. And that's a term that also means hell and the grave. And you got to figure out which one we're talking about by the context. So sometimes it just means the grave. Sometimes it actually means what we think of as hell. And this is what I mean by what we think of as hell. So actually, I can't get this image out of my mind. Whenever I think of hell, I think of Yosemite Sam. You guys know who Yosemite Sam is? Dressed up in a red suit with a pitchfork and that whole thing, picking on Bugs Bunny, and he's in a cave with fire all around him and that kind of stuff. And so that is the classical representation of hell. That's what would be called Hades in the Bible, okay? And so it is a place of torment. Jesus talked about this in Luke 16. It's a place of torment, but it's not the final destination of the unrighteous dead. The final destination of the unrighteous dead is the lake of fire. Okay? And so when people die today and they are unbelievers, they go to Hades and they're kept there until the last judgment. Okay? The only unbeliever that that doesn't work for, or the only unbelievers that doesn't work for, is the Antichrist and the false prophet. The beast and the false prophet go straight to the lake of fire. They don't go to Hades. Okay? Along with Hades, there were two parts of Hades, and so Jesus talks about a place that was called Abraham's bosom. He also called it paradise. And so there was a place of comfort in Hades for the righteous dead until the death of Jesus and his resurrection. And then the Bible teaches that he took those people who were there waiting for the coming of the Messiah, and he took them to be with him in heaven. And so now paradise has changed places. Now paradise is in heaven, okay? And so that place is empty right now. There is also a gulf that Jesus said was fixed between the comfort portion of Hades and the torment portion of Hades. And that gulf is called in other places, I believe, Tartarus or the pit, the abyss. That's the abyss. And that is a place for particularly evil fallen angels. And so not all the fallen angels are in the abyss or in the pit or in Tartarus, but the Bible talks about a certain class of fallen angels that sinned during the time of Noah. And you can read about them in Genesis chapter 6. It looks like those fallen angels are released during the tribulation period. And you see that in Revelation chapter 9. Revelation chapter 9. In any case, that's the pit, or that's the abyss, okay? And then everybody who is in Hades, which includes the torment portion and the pit, end up in the lake of fire. And so when I talk to people about this is kind of like how we do our justice system. What we do is we arrest a guy, and he needs to have a trial, but we can't necessarily just let him go. Unless you live in New York, okay, then you just let him go. But he has to have a trial, and so if he can't make bail, we do bail. They didn't do bail back in these days. If you can't make bail, what you have to do is you go to county jail and you stay in a pod in county jail until the time for your trial comes up. And then you come and stand before the judge for your trial, and if it's found that you did this thing, then you are put into prison, okay, and I'm talking about like major, like felonies and that kind of stuff. Then you are taken and you are put into prison. It's kind of the same picture that you've got here. When a person dies and they're an unbeliever, they go to county jail, Hades, and that's where they stay until their trial. Their trial is at the end of chapter 20. It's called the Great White Throne Judgment. Then they stand before God, they're tried, and then they're put into the prison, into the lockup, and that is the lake of fire. And so that's the picture that you've got in the Bible. Okay, so having said all that, the Antichrist just goes straight to the lake of fire. The Antichrist is not going to appear before God. He's not going to have any kind of judgment. He goes straight to the lake of fire, okay? He's treated like a fallen angel, basically, okay? Then Jesus has come back. He's on the earth at this point. And in chapter 20, look at verse 1. It says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit." That's the abyss that I was just talking about. "And a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up." I love that phrase, shut him up. "And set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while." And if you go back to Isaiah, I'm just going to give you the reference here. Isaiah chapter 24, verses 21 and 22 talks about the fact that not only is Satan bound in the bottomless pit, but all his minions. And sorry about using, all I think of is little yellow guys when I say that. But all his minions go to the pit with him. according to the book of Isaiah, okay? And so at this point, Jesus has come back. He's about to start the 1,000-year reign. He gets rid of the devil and all the demons, and they go to the pit, go to the bottomless pit for 1,000 years. And then they're released at the end of that 1,000-year period. It says in verse 7, it says, "Now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog." They've got a grudge because they lost it at the beginning of the tribulation, "to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire." There's no judgment for him. There's no standing before the great white throne and him being judged. He's just cast into the lake of fire. He's cast in the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are. Not were, are. "And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever." Okay? And so, again, here's the thing. I just read this, and so it already opens up a can of worms. You have the 1,000-year reign. During that 1,000-year reign, Satan is not allowed to tempt anybody, okay, until the end of the 1,000-year reign. And then God releases him and has him go out and tempt these people. Why? And the reason is because they have been under the kingdom authority of Jesus Christ. These people have been that in that situation for a thousand years with no choices. They're just there, and they have to be there, and they have to obey, and they have no choices. Now, having said that, it's a perfect kingdom. And so you have a perfect king who's perfectly righteous, perfectly good, perfectly gracious, perfectly kind. He perfectly provides for you. You have a perfect environment. You have a perfect society. Sin is dealt with. There's sin during this period of time because it's populated by people who did not die in the tribulation and came through it. And so they have children. There's sin that takes place during this time, obviously, because they rebel at the end of it, right? And so they've gone through this whole 1,000-year period, and it's a perfect government, a perfect environment, a perfect society, all the things we blame for our sin. We are blame shifters. And so I sin, it's not my fault, it's the fault of my parents and my upbringing. Okay, so it's their fault. Or I sin, it's not my fault, it's society's fault. Or I sin, it's not my fault, it's because I had a bad environment. I was poor, things were awful, you know, there was famine, you know, people come up with all kinds of things. Or I sin because of the man. The man makes me sin. He's, you know, the government is so unrighteous. And so we go through as a people and we blame everything for our sin except for ourselves. And what you have during the 1,000-year reign of Christ is a perfect government, and again, environment. Everything is perfect. Everything is good during that period of time, and man still rebels at the end of it. And it is to show that sin is not something that comes from the outside. It's the problem that I've got on the inside, right? And so, again, you have that. Here's another thing about this. We are going to be in that 1,000-year reign too, but we are not going to be people who are going to fall to this nonsense, because we will be perfected at that point. We're going to have glorified bodies. Our sin is already taken care of. We're made perfect at this point, but we're going to rule and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. And guess what you're probably going to be doing? You're probably going to be warning about what's happening in verse 7 and 8. You're going to be warning these people that this dude, the Satan, is going to come along and he's going to lie through his teeth to these people, try to turn you away from the Lord who loves you, and he's going to try to take you to the pit with him. Well, not the pit, but the lake of fire with him. I really believe that that's most of what we're going to be doing during that time, because you're going to have a whole, just generations of people who have never been tempted by the devil, never been tempted by the devil, and had nothing but a perfect lifestyle, basically, and they still rebel, and so they're destroyed. And so fire comes down and destroys these people who attack, and then the devil is cast in the lake of fire where the beast and the false prophet are. So the beast and the false prophet have been there for 1,000 years in the lake of fire, and they are still there after 1,000 years. And this is where the controversial part comes in. People have a hard time with the idea that God would take and populate the lake of fire with people who are never going to be destroyed, never going to be wiped out. They're going to be there for eternity. And people have a problem with that. I would just submit to you that you can tell how deep you are in a hole by how long the rope is that gets you out. Right? You've heard me talk about this before. We are deep in a hole because the rope that God had to use to get me out of the hole that I'm in is that God had to come down himself, live the life that I'm supposed to live, do it perfectly in a fallen world where he's never really appreciated in the way that he's supposed to be, including by his disciples. And then finally, as an act of gratitude for everything that he'd ever done, including telling the truth and speaking righteousness to people, healing people, blessing people, doing all that kind of stuff, we took and nailed him to a cross and killed him like he's a criminal. And then God uses that to save me from my sin. He takes my penalty upon himself to save me from my sin. You know why he does all that? Because the alternative is hell for eternity. That's why he does all that. Otherwise, it could be something much simpler than that, right? And so the alternative to salvation is so horrendous that God does the ultimate sacrifice in coming down to this earth. Now, I just gave it to you from Jesus's perspective. Jesus is God coming to the earth. Let's take it from the Father's perspective. And I've talked about this before. You know, I have a son. I love my son. If it was a choice between giving my son up for you or giving myself up for you, if I had to sacrifice something for you, guess what I would sacrifice? It would be me all day long. I would never give my son for you. Sorry, love ya. Never gonna happen. Because I love him, right? And if I ever did give my son for you, it would be the ultimate sacrifice. There's nothing that you could do to pay me back for that. Nothing that you could do. And if you ever thought that you could pay me back for that, I would be offended. Right? Speaking from a father's heart, I would be totally offended if you came up to me and said, you know, Steve, appreciate the sacrifice of your son. I know that you had to make a choice there. I'd like to give you a check. And what proceeded after that would not be good. It would not be good, right? Or if you came up to me and you said anything along the lines of, really appreciate you sacrificing your son for me, but just want you to know that I probably could have made it out on my own. And so you didn't really need to do that. And what would come from that would be not good for you. It would be not good. You see what I mean? All this stuff is personal. And so when I was first a Christian, I would look at Jesus and the sacrifice that he made. And I think that that's mostly where most of us are. We're looking at the sacrifice of Christ for us, and we're so thankful for that he would give himself up for that, because, you know, basically it looks like he's the one doing the work. And he is. But if I had a choice between being Jesus or being the Father, I would pick Jesus every day. Every day. I would never want to be the Father. And that's why the Bible, when it talks about God's love for you, it says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever would believe in him would not perish but have everlasting life. There's a lot in that verse to unpack, and most of it has to do with that relationship between the Father and the Son and what kind of sacrifice the Father made for us. Okay? And so, again, when you're looking at the price that had to be paid for my salvation, there's a reason that it was so expensive. And it's because the alternative is so bad. It's so bad. Now, it goes on and says, I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one according to his works. Then death and Hades were cast in the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Okay, let's unpack that. Okay, so at this point, you already have the resurrection of the righteous. That's already taken place. And so you have the righteous dead that were raised with Jesus. You have the general resurrection of the dead that takes place when Christ comes back for the church. You have another resurrection of the dead that takes place in verse 4 of chapter 20 of everybody who died during the tribulation period. And they are called the first resurrection. And that again is the resurrection of the just. Just and unjust. First resurrection of the just. Second resurrection is the resurrection of the unjust. And that's what we're seeing right here. And so it's a resurrection. That means they get bodies, right? And Jesus talked about that in John chapter 5. He said that when you go to the grave, when I call you out of the grave, or when you're called out of the grave at the last judgment, it's going to be my voice that you hear. You think you're going to hear the Father's voice. It's not going to be the Father's voice that you hear. It's going to be my voice that you hear. And so these people are transported back into their bodies. They're raised from the dead at that point. And so they get a resurrection body just like yours and mine. They're resurrected. And they go to heaven, too. They go to heaven. Because the great white throne is in heaven. Do all roads lead to heaven? Yep. All roads lead to heaven. That's not the problem. The problem is what happens when you get there, right? And so Satan is a master liar. He goes around and he makes statements like that, all roads lead to heaven, and he's laughing while he's making it, and especially when somebody who mocks the Bible or mocks the salvation that comes through Christ is propounding that, because that is exactly what's going to happen to that person. They are going to be standing in heaven in a resurrected body. So the power, the Bible talks about when we're raised from the dead, that we're going to be higher than the angels. And so even the unbelievers are going to be raised from the dead, and they are going to be effectively higher than the angels as they're standing before God. And as they're standing before God, they're going to be able to see him in all his glory. They're going to see Christ. They're going to see the Holy Spirit there. They're going to see all of us, everybody who's ever witnessed to them, everybody who's ever told them about the Lord. They're going to see all of us ruling and reigning with Christ, and they're going to be standing there in judgment knowing what's coming.
You've been listening to Crosswalk with Pastor Steve Winery. Crosswalk is the radio ministry of Calvary Chapel Tri-Cities in Kennewick, Washington. If you're wanting to know more about what it means to follow Christ, then please contact our church office by phone at 509-736-2086. You can also look us up online at calvary-tricities.org. There you will find a wide variety of Steve's teachings to listen to or to download for free. If you want to join us for church sometime, we're located at 10611 West Clearwater Avenue in Kennewick, Washington. Our Sunday service times are 8:30 and 10:30 a.m. and 6 p.m. We also meet on Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. We hope you have been blessed today and will join us again next time on Crosswalk.